News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Each week, we visit with veterans of World War II, and the idea is really threefold. First of all, we want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. They are the reason that our country remains free, them and all the men and women serving in our armed forces today as well. We want to preserve their stories for posterity so people don't forget the huge price that has been paid for that freedom that we have. And hopefully along the way, we learn a thing or two about our own realities and what created it a long time ago. And I think you'll be interested here today to know, you know, often on this show I talk about who wouldn't be here if a veteran didn't survive the war. And we'll get to that this week. But there's also a business that wouldn't be here that if you're a KMJ listener, you're familiar with. Because I know I listen to KMJ and I hear the commercials all the time with the deep baritone of Al Smith telling us about the Small Business Awards brought to you by Murphy Bank. Well, guess what? We're going to hear a little bit of the story behind Murphy Bank today. Without our veteran that's joining us today, there would be no Murphy Bank if he hadn't survived all his missions in the air during World War II and the Korean conflict. Then none of that would have materialized. So I welcome in Mike Murphy, 88 years old. He lives in Fresno, originally from El Paso, Texas. It's pretty hot and dry there, too. I'm curious, Mike, I like to ask every veteran that I have on the show about a specific date in history, because everybody seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were when you heard that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and what that meant to you at the time?
Yes, I was having breakfast in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was in college at Carnegie Tech at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at nights from 3 to 11 for the FBI answering the telephones.
Mm.
And so when I listened to this, I called the office to see if I should do something. And they said, show up on time tonight as usual. And that was the memory of it all to me.
Sounds like they didn't think it was that big of a deal or didn't want you to think so.
No, they had long-term problems and they didn't want me getting in their way about sides of it.
And I'm sure you didn't, but eventually they would need you in another role. Did you have any ideas in those first few weeks after Pearl Harbor that you might be in a uniform soon and serving Uncle Sam in a different capacity?
It never crossed my mind. I thought I was going to be in the FBI for the next 20 years.
Uh-huh.
But in point of fact, I got drafted the day I graduated from college, and that took care of that one.
And I haven't talked to too many guys. A lot of the guys that I talked to that became pilots during World War II enlisted on their own volition and chose to be pilots and had to kind of rise to the top of the heap to have that distinction. You go from drafted to being a bomber pilot. How did that happen? How did you end up in a B-17?
Well, I was such a poor pilot in training. I didn't do well upside down, so I couldn't be a fighter pilot if I had to.
What went wrong when you were upside down?
We were only allowed to deviate from the assigned course 15 degrees when we did a slow roll, and I was only I was about 90 degrees off every time. I don't know. I don't think upside down.
Well, I don't think I could either. And I'm glad that you survived that because that sounds like you might have been in some danger with those conditions. But so because of that, you didn't think you qualified for a fighter pilot or they didn't think you were qualified to fly fighters and you ended up in bombs.
I would say everybody agreed with that one.
Uh-huh. Didn't have to convince anybody.
No.
But it's quite a different task flying a big, heavy bomber with 10 men on your crew than being in one of those fighters.
Particularly if you're of a small frame. We didn't have the hydraulic boosts and all the things that they have today. We had very meager instruments at mm-hmm. the time. And we had, in England, plenty of fog to get it through, coming and going. The 8th Air Force was a study in discipline, and the story about the discipline has never been told as far as I'm concerned.
Here's your opportunity.
When you think about the fact that we would every day take about 12 to 1,500 bombers in the air at the same time in a space about the size of half of Fresno County, mm-hmm. and in the fog at 6 a.m. in the morning, and in England in the winter, you don't have any sunshine until about 10 o'clock anyway, mm-hmm. and climb to perhaps 25,000 feet, assemble very tight, and make our way across to Germany. They planned us our missions so that we'd bomb at about 11:30 with the sun at our back so we could see. And so that was a routine area. But it didn't end there because there was intensive flak almost every target. Sometimes, like Berlin, over 1,200 88 caliber were shooting every second at you. Mm-hmm. And it would form a black cloud over the target. And you'd go right through the black cloud.
And you had to. And this is one of the things that's always fascinated me about bomber pilots in World War II, and all the crewmen, too, because they knew what you were doing. Because of what you just described, the number of planes in the air, as tightly packed as they were, there's nothing you can do to avoid any of this flak, and you have no choice but to fly through it.
That's exactly the truth. You go right through it and see your Hail Marys and come out the other side.
Well, that's what I've always wondered, what it's like that split second before when you see that black cloud and you know you're going to feel something and your plane is going to go rat-a-tat-tat. What goes through your mind? And do you hold your breath? I mean, what do you do?
Well, I think you're too busy at that point, mm-hmm. to even think about it all. The navigator's trying to get you out of that place as quickly as possible. The bombardier has his eye glued to the bomb side. There are pictures on every plane were taken immediately as your bombs went away.
Right.
So they knew exactly where your bombs landed. Mm-hmm. And everybody was watching that as closely as possible. And we were concerned about damage. Sometimes we'd get things that didn't work, like an engine or something like that.
Yeah, that's somewhat important to have four working engines, yeah.
There was so much excitement that there was little time to think about it all. So, and then what most people don't understand, we were at 25,000 feet without any heating, mm-hmm. or any air pressurization. So if you had to go to the bathroom, you were in a hell of a mess. These were the human side, because you've been gone now for 6 or 8 hours. Mm-hmm. A mission would generally take about 11 hours. There wasn't any way for you to eat during that time. Everything was frozen. You couldn't touch any metal with it because of the cold. Mm-hmm. It was another life.
Did you wear an electrically heated suit?
Yes, yes.
I've talked to some people who said they wore the sheepskin because they knew that was going to keep them somewhat warm, but you could stay nice and toasty with the electric suit, I suppose.
As long as it worked, it was in good shape, yes.
And how many missions did you fly with the 305th Bomb Group in World War II?
I put 30, because the fighters were under control. When I went over in May of 1944, the requirement was 35. And at the end of it all, I had a choice of signing on a second tour or going back to the training command. And with my temperament, it was not good for me to go back to training command. So I elected to stay. And so it was, that was the reason I had more time. It's like anything else. You get used to it. And I enjoyed the discipline. I didn't have any problems when you talk about being on time. Mm-hmm. We're talking about not being a half a second late, not 1 minute late. They would give us hell if we were a minute late because everybody else was running out of gas and you couldn't mess around. And I thought it was absolutely wonderful to see all these people 18 years to 22 years of age to be able to control them and knowing that they all were young and immature as I was. And I think that was really a tribute to the people that ran the place.
And you were all of 21 years old when you flew your first mission.
Yes.
Was flying that plane with that firepower, with nine other men on the plane whose lives depended on your abilities, did that feel like a lot of responsibility to you at the time?
Yes, of course. You had so many things on your mind, and everybody had the same problems. You didn't think in those terms, but it was obvious that, not to be selfish, you didn't want to kill yourself. Yeah, and you were all in the same boat.
Everybody seems to have some kind of memory of that first mission. Was your first mission on D-Day shortly after? It was on D-Day.
On D-Day. Yes.
Tell me about that.
In our unit, we were always would take a new crew and break them up. So I was in another cruise when we went, and nobody knew where we were going. And when we got there, it was absolutely awesome to see. I don't know. I've heard all sorts of numbers, but something like 17,000 people in the air at one time. In a space not too big, and there were just everything was happening at one time. It was the only occasion where we flew like that. It wasn't a strategic target, and so after the initial bombing back of the lines, then we were assigned back into Germany the next day. Mm-hmm. But it was just the awesome side of this tremendous amount of people, gliders everywhere. And you would think about the poor guy in the glider and the guy on the parachute shooting out and knowing that he didn't know what he was getting into. It was awesome.
And you described seeing all the planes in the air. I imagine if you looked down, you saw quite a few ships in the channel too.
Oh, the thing was full of them. And we didn't have that much time to do anything. We were so busy doing our thing, you know.
I don't blame you. I think that day, probably more than any other, speaks to what I sense is one of the things that you are most impressed by with the military that you served in World War II, this ability to organize that big of a force and keep them from messing each other up? Because, I mean, one guy makes a mistake and there can be a pretty big domino effect. Is that safe to say that that's one of the things you're most impressed by and left the biggest impression on you?
Yes, is the answer. But the thing that jumped out at me in the middle of it all is that leaders begin to rise inside the ranks. And West Point did his thing. But the real leadership came out of civilian colleges all over the world. It was just, to me, awesome to see the people that really had the ability to take command. Now, you can't hold these people in peace time. They won't accept that. They're doers, and they get out of the service and go on their way. In the time of war, you need every one of them.
In all the veterans that I've interviewed, I get the sense, too, that, I mean, from the ones who were leaders to the ones that maybe were more toward the follower side, but these millions and millions of Americans who were wearing a uniform and were part of the cause, I think they all found out that they were capable of more than they probably ever imagined they would. A lot of these guys that you're talking about as leaders probably never envisioned themselves that way before this whole thing started. Would you agree with that?
That's absolutely true.
Is that what your own experience feels like?
Well, what happened to me personally is that it gave me a discipline that I use every day of my life, a discipline of getting my priorities in order and focusing on what's important. It's hard to get this in civilian life without the threat of war and that sort of thing. You don't realize how important this really is.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. Right now, we need to take our first commercial break. But when we come back, we'll examine more than just the first mission Mike Murphy flew. We're going to talk about some of the others, like the two times he was shot down. Well, how is he here to tell us about it and never spent any time in a prisoner of war camp? He'll explain that to us. And we'll also hear about his life since World War II and how one of those businesses you hear about all the time here on these airwaves came into being. You're listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and I have three words for you. Ready? Duration, premium, cool. Duration Premium Cool Roofing Shingles from Owens Corning Roofing come with state-of-the-art reflective granules that lower the amount of solar energy entering your home. That means your AC may not have to work so hard, resulting in an energy bill that will go the only direction you ever want it to go, down. I did it. You can, too. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool at a Pacific Supply location near you. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the Valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. And now, one of its football coaches is former All-Pro quarterback Daryl LaMonica. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're visiting today with 88-year-old Mike Murphy of Fresno, California, a recipient of the Distinguished Flying Cross a couple times over. 55 missions he flew as a B-17 pilot in World War II. If you listen to this show and you've heard some other pilots and some other airmen, you know that 55 missions in bombers in World War II is a lot. He flew those with the 305th Bomb Group, part of the 8th Air Force. And a couple times along the way, things didn't go as planned. Let's talk about December 15th, 1944, the first time that you were, I'll use the phrase, shot down.
The target was the bridge in back of Cologne that crossed the Rhine, and the mission was to make it unusable for the Germans that were in the Battle of the Bulge,
right.
So they couldn't supply through there. And what happened is that we were very, very carefully instructed not to hit the cathedral. And anybody that's been to Cologne knows that the bridge goes right up to the back of the cathedral. So it was very important not to have that hit. And for reasons I'll never know, when you load the bomber in the morning or then wherever, they have a safety switch in the bomb bay to protect the loaders. And they put that so that it deactivates all the electronic side. Then after they've loaded it, then they move the switch back on so that the bombardier has control of it.
Right.
Well, this particular occasion, apparently nobody moved the switch back on, and so the first pass, nothing came out. So everybody suspected the same thing, and to go around, you have to get out of the way of everybody else. See, there's a group every minute going across the targets, and so you can't just turn around. You have to be a sizable loop around. Well, by then, the Palmer column had passed away on its way, and then we had our second pass, and by then, they had a pretty good idea of our altitudes, and then we really got hit at that point. Now the question is, do you bail out and end up as a prisoner of war, or do you stay with the and nurse the bomber back into friendly territory and get out at that point one way or the other? And the answer to in our case was to nurse it back. Only nursing it back wasn't as simple as it sounded, because a couple of engines, one engine wouldn't feather, and that's a real problem, meaning it created a vibration that's absolutely incredible. And another engine didn't work at all, and there was a fire in there, and in back of the engine is a firewall, and then the gas for the plane is in the wing and back of that. So there's a certain amount of apprehension that goes with seeing a fire like that.
Especially when you're 21 years old and you got nine other men on the plane you're responsible for.
Well, it just, even when you're trying to take care of yourself, I mean, but at this, no, your father would attest to the fact that there was snow on the ground about hip deep anyway.
Yeah, and this is a day before the Battle of the Bulge officially began, December 1544.
Right in the middle of it all, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And you see, the delicate part is that we wanted to help the people in the Battle of the Bulge, but the weather was so bad that we couldn't get in there. There was no way. It was just a wall of clouds from the ground up to about 30,000 feet. Mm-hmm. And no way that we could help them at all. So when we got one clear day, at semi-clear, that was the occasion. And we could only go for targets that were clear enough for us to know what we were doing. So it actually belting in the snow was not that big a deal anyway.
But so you make your first pass, your bombs don't release, so then you have to get back in line. You're using more gas. You're exposing yourself to the anti-aircraft fire again.
Yes.
You get hit so bad that two of your engines are out. One of them's on fire, close to the gasoline, which may explode at any moment. Mm-hmm. And you, as the pilot, have this decision that you have to make. Did you make that decision by yourself? Did you put it to a vote of the crew? How did you decide whether to bail out?
There is no vote in things like that. You do the best you can.
So what made you decide not to get out of what was basically then a flying bomb that didn't look like it was going anywhere in good shape?
Well, you know, parachutes were not that good at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And many people were killed just trying to get out of bombers.
Sure.
And it wasn't exactly the first choice if you had any control at all. And really, I felt that we were going to get back to a field in France that we could land on.
Is that what happened?
No. We ended up outside of Liège, between Liège and Brussels, in that area.
So tell me about it. What did it look like? What was that landing like?
Rough.
You just went down in a field of snow?
Yeah.
With the wheels down or the wheels up?
Or, the wheels have to be up.
The wheels are up. And the last few years, we have had a media firestorm for the pilot who brought his passenger plane down in a frozen Hudson River.
Yeah, yeah.
You're bringing down a bomber with fewer people, but down on snow-covered ground with no wheels, trying to make sure that everybody on that plane lives. Was that tough, or was it? Did it seem easy to you at the time?
I wasn't that good a pilot. I was very relieved that we were all in one place.
I'm guessing you had never practiced belly landing in the snow.
Never, never. I hadn't even thought about it.
So you're just saying...
See, the problem is that in Europe, the fields are not that great, and there are lots of hedgerows and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And so you don't have as many choices as you appear. That's what hurt the people landing in France. The hedgerows just ate the gliders alive.
Mm-hmm.
They ran into them and turned upside down.
In terms of your landing in the snow, December 15th of 44, did it seem like it took forever to come to a stop and to realize that you actually made it down, that everybody was going to live? And then what'd you do from there?
Well, we got out and were met by American ground troops.
That must have been a relief.
They didn't trust us. They had been fooled by the Germans too many times with American uniforms and everything else and American equipment. And they didn't know it, so they wanted to know who we were and what we were doing.
How'd you finally convince them?
Oh, just a matter of they asked where were you born and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to see if you could come up with logical answers.
Did you bust out some Texas twang for them to try to convince them?
No. In El Paso, we were too far west for that.
Too far west for the twang. I got you.
It would be better to break out in Mexican.
Probably, right on the border. You're describing it, and I know you lived it, and it's been how many years now? 67 years since that. But it just seems so traumatic, so hair-raising, so scary to me that... Were you scared at the time? Were you at all nervous?
Of course. Everybody. I don't care who you are. You just, if you do it every day, you would be scared. It's a life-threatening situation.
And I'm curious if you got any kind of feedback from your crew after you brought that plane safely down in the snow, if you got a few pats on the back or thank yous from the other guys?
One man was killed when he tried to bail out, and it didn't work.
Mm.
And other than that, we were all happy, It was such a trauma of the ground troops not believing who you are, that sort of thing. It wasn't exactly... they were not glad to see us. No, it was kind of a strange situation.
I can imagine to go from the relief of making it onto safe ground and then maybe getting shot by your own guys because they don't believe you. That wouldn't be very fun.
I think that the things like this become reality perhaps a day later or even a week later. Yeah, something like that.
And if that's the case, did it occur to you that you might be in a similar position again if you're going to keep flying, that you're going to have to make those kind of split-second decisions or be able to perform those kind of actions again someday?
You don't think in those terms, or you can't afford to. You assume that next time it's going to be all right.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, you talked earlier about the way you live your life and your priorities. That's a big thing for you, not looking back, right?
Yes. Yes. That's very important.
What does that do for you? Why is that so crucial?
Because in the banking business, everybody's heard about all the problems that the banks have had. And if you're going to sit and meditate on that, you can't go forward. And I think that we came through this in good shape. And we have to look and see where we're going. We have to be on the cow catcher and not in the caboose.
You know? Anybody that knows trains gets that analogy.
They don't even know what a cow catcher is anymore.
We still got enough cows around the valley that hopefully some of our dairy friends will remember the cow catcher on the front of the train. Before we catch this next commercial, I want to ask you about the second time that you were in a situation like this. Now, this is less than a month before the war ended in Europe. Not that you would have necessarily known that then, but April the 16th happens to be my wife's birthday. April the 16th, 1945, you were shot down over Bordeaux. Is that right?
Yes. North of there, the Germans had a little group that had gotten kind of trapped in there and were denying the use of the Bordeaux harbor because they held the estuary around there. And we were assigned to go down and loosen it up a little bit for the French. To this day, nobody knows whether we got hit or not, first of all, because we were the only ones that had this engine go out, and it created a real problem. And we were on the downwind leg of getting in position to bomb. We were at 20,000 feet, and this engine broke off. It exploded. We had a full bomb in the bomb bay, and we fell to about 7,000 almost immediately, and then got control at that point and jettisoned the bombs to get some relief. And again, there was fire in that engine. And so the only thing to do was to set it down as quickly as possible. And in this case, it was in the Bay of Biscay, just off of Bordeaux.
So you'd had your snow landing. Now you had to get a water landing on your resume.
Yes, about 10 miles out.
And you described that engine exploding. So you don't know if it was hit or it just malfunctioned, but it explodes and all of a sudden you're a heavy rock going straight down to the ground.
Yes.
What? How do you respond in that situation? It sounds like chaos and catastrophe.
I think that there is an element of chaos in the middle of it all. There's nothing that I think in flying that worries you more than fire, because you have all this gasoline right around you. In a bomber, unlike a fighter, you really can't bail out. You have to go to a door to get to out, and the doors are not everywhere around those.
Especially if your nose is pointed down toward the ground.
And so it sounds better in Hollywood than it does in reality. But what happens is that moment by moment, you do what you have to do to gain control. That's the thing that is the frightening part of it, is when you don't want to go head on into the bay, and that's where all this bomb load and everything else was taking us.
So, well, and obviously I've never been in that situation, but I just trying to imagine myself in your shoes, it seems like a situation where you're almost wrestling the airplane and trying to use every bit of your strength to stabilize this thing and get it back level.
Yes, exactly.
And you don't know if you'll ever win that battle, right? I mean, until it happens.
You have no idea, and you're not trained for that.
So there how'd you do it?
Well, you just, I don't know, you just do. they have what they call tabs on all aircraft. If you're reasonably quick and you can control it with the tabs. Because I wasn't physically strong enough, the tabs, I made it important to learn how to use the tabs as a way of device.
Good thing you did.
Yeah, I think that sometimes we don't realize how much of this is going on around us every day. In war, you expect it. To this day, nobody knows whether we got hit or not. Mm-hmm. you can have a mechanical explosion, particularly at that time when there was such stress on the planes and the maintenance and everything else.
Sure. So I guess the important thing is that you were able to stabilize that plane. You're able to save the lives of the guys on your plane, including your own, and you bring it down in the water. Again, probably something you'd never practiced before?
No.
No, of course not. But we know he pulled it off. Otherwise, you wouldn't be hearing this story. And we'll get the rest of that story when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ. Rising energy bills got you down? Paul Leffler here telling you to look up. As in, look up to the top of your house and put your roof to work for your wallet. I want to tell you about Duration Premium Cool, the Energy Star rated roofing shingles from Owens Corning Roofing and Asphalt. I don't have to tell you how hot California summers can get, but did you know that installing a cool roof can help fend off that heat? You can take your pick from four distinctive colors. We have sage on top of the Leffler home, but what makes Duration Premium Cool shingles so special is the reflective granule technology that basically bounces sunlight back up to the sky so it doesn't get absorbed into your home. Duration Premium Cool shingles are proven to reflect up to 25% of that solar energy targeting your house on a hot summer day. So you may not have to use your AC as much, potentially giving your air conditioner a rest. So don't just get any roof, get an energy efficient cool roof from Owens Corning. Find out more at owenscorning.com or ask for Duration Premium Cool shingles at a Pacific Supply location near you.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We will not have time for all of Mike Murphy's stories today. 88 years is enough time for more than a few adventures, and we're not even going to touch on his drives across Europe and Asia to India. You'll have to wait for his book to come out for those. When we left off, he had wrestled back control of his crippled B-17 and was preparing to land in the Bay of Biscay. A water landing was something the first lieutenant had never had the opportunity to practice before. But you did know, Mike, what could potentially go wrong, didn't you?
Everybody had seen pictures of water landings, so you had some idea of what you were trying to do.
You pretend you're a PBY and just envision it that way?
About the size of it, yes.
So how did that go? How was the water landing, and were you afraid that you wouldn't make it?
It was rough. To put it mildly, the surface of the ocean was absolutely glass, so that helped. And the Bay of Biscay is famous for being rough, so we were saved by God on that one.
He calmed the waters for you.
Oh, yes, yes. One of the things that haunts everybody is to have your nose go down and flip. And so because of that, you tend to hold the nose higher than perhaps you should. You don't know where to have it.
Right.
And as a result, you hit with your tail first, and B-17s weren't meant to do that. So you crack the frame by the way you hit the water, That would be expected.
So now you've...
Really don't float, is what I'm saying.
They don't float. It's broken in two, and you got guys trying to swim and survive.
Yeah, you have dinghies, and you have procedures, and it happened so fast. The way we were trained, everybody got into the radio room for that sort of thing, but in this case, nobody could get in there, so that... It put us in a different light, but everybody got out in good shape, and no big deal.
I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I'm curious, as I envision myself in your shoes with your headset on and trying to bring this plane safely down, and you've got these other crewmen that are there, is it quiet and they're giving you space to try to pull this off, or were people barking stuff at you and panicking, and how did you focus?
There's so much noise that you can't hear anybody.
Mm-hmm. The noise of the plane and all of that.
Yeah. So the thing that they don't show you in the movies, we had our parachutes hung from our armpits, and it was a bulky affair, so it was kind of a nuisance, but that's the only way you could. We had chest packs.
Right.
And you couldn't have it on your chest because it would get in your way. So the art of the game is when you needed it, you would hook it up, but it was hanging there. On the other side, you had electric boots on, and the last thing in the world, if you went down, is to be without shoes. So you had your big old GI shoes hanging on the other side of you.
Uh-huh.
So you looked like you were some outer space guy, and you couldn't squeeze through a window or a door without taking off something or both of them.
Mm-hmm.
There was no way. You were just too bulky. Almost like a comedy trying to decide what to do and how to get out of the place, you know.
It's probably a lot easier to laugh about it now than it was then.
It was a mess.
And it wasn't over. You're safely in the water. You didn't die. But
no.
Now you probably don't know where you are and who's going to pick you up.
Well, I knew where I was, but I didn't know who was going to come out. And so at about sunset, a boat came out, a fishing boat, and it was two Frenchmen, and they hauled us in. That was the beginning of my love for France.
I don't blame you. And I think the feeling's mutual on their end, too. Was it tricky for them to get you back to American forces?
No, not at all.
Fairly simple.
Yeah. Bordeaux was a free city. But the estuary wasn't. The only thing is that we were concerned that Germans would send out something, and which they had the ability to do, but I think they were too busy.
I think our listeners are probably thinking this, and I can't help but go here. If someone had told you before you ever flew a mission, here you are at the time you flew your first mission, 21 years old, if they said, you're going to have to land a B-17, a crippled, disabled B-17, on snow and in the water, in a sea, and you're going to have to do that in order to survive. Would that have sounded a little intimidating or maybe even impossible to you?
At that age, I doubt if I would have understood it. You know, at that age, you're indestructible,
mm-hmm.
At least in your mind, and it would sound like a high-speed roller coaster to the kids today. You know, it wouldn't have any meaning. It'd be fun.
What about now? Is it hard to believe now that that's the way it happened?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
You ever think that if one thing had gone wrong there, that you never would have met your wife, Dolores, been married for 53 years now, no kids, no grandkids, and for all the people who've benefited from your business, no Murphy Bank?
Well, oddly enough, this is kind of corny to many people, but I felt that God was looking after me. And I didn't feel that he was going to allow me to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I feel that he's guided me through everything I have. That's the way it is. I don't feel that I've done anything. I just follow his guidance.
Well, I don't think any of us could argue with that or come up with a wiser way to live our lives. And I would say that the stories you've told us are pretty good proof that he was looking out for you, give you reason to trust him. I'm curious if after all that, when May 8th of 45 rolls around and the war in Europe is over, was that a day of celebration for you?
Well, we didn't even know it was over. They were negotiating and with individual commanders of the German army, and there wasn't any central command until D.C. announced that we had won. We didn't even know about it, that it was such a mixed-up affair. At that time, Patton and other ones like him were doing everything possible to gain ground for the post-war side,
mm-hmm.
and as a first lieutenant in the Air Force, I didn't know beans about what they were doing, and nobody called to tell me what they were doing.
Imagine
so,
that.
I think that it's more exciting when you're a civilian and you hear it or see it on the in the news than when you're actually there.
That said, was it a special thing for you, a big moment to get back to the States after those 55 missions?
I didn't get back. That's the problem. The unit was declared as part of the Army of Occupation and sent to Belgium with a mission to photograph all of Europe from 20,000 feet and make a massive mosaic of Europe. And we were assigned almost immediately to fly back and forth across Europe taking pictures. Mm. And in my case, I was assigned to Iceland immediately. I had points everywhere to go home, but I couldn't get anybody to send me home because I was assigned to an active duty.
Mm-hmm. So, it must have been nice to fly when you knew there wasn't going to be any flak, though.
Yes, yes, yes. And I really enjoyed studying Europe from 20,000 feet. You could put it on automatic pilot and get on course and sit and study it, which I thought was great.
Now, we only have so many minutes left in the show, but I know that your adventures didn't stop there. You flew again in Korea, which I guess if your philosophy is what you said, that you felt God was looking out for you and he carried you through those missions you described, why not go back and fly some more in Korea? But you also spent some time working for the FBI after the war?
When I got out of the service in 1945, I was assigned to L.A., and I was there until I got recalled for Korea.
Twice you're with the FBI, and the Army tells you, no, we need you here. And I guess you finally got the message that you weren't going to be a career FBI guy?
Yeah, well, it became obvious. By then, I was tired of being on that side. I wanted to get out and do something else.
And I know there are a lot of stories here that we're not going to have time to tell, but we're going to be able to read about this in a book pretty soon?
Well, I'm not too sure how much it's going to be in the public, but at this moment, the lady is writing the story and others.
When you are done and it's ready, let me know so I can tell all our listeners about it. And I want to hear how you ended up in Fresno, because you're from El Paso, you're going to school in Pittsburgh, you're all over the world in airplanes, and somehow all roads lead to Fresno. How did that work out?
Well, Carl Falk was head of the social science division at Fresno State, and I met him in Germany. I got my doctorate from London School of Economics in 1954, and Carl offered me a job to teach at Fresno State, and so I came here for that purpose. And I never had enough money to leave.
Well, and you made the transition from that to starting your own business, which now supports other small businesses. And we hear that on KMJ all the time, the Spotlight on Small Business Awards presented by Murphy Bank. Did you imagine when you started Murphy Bank that it would still be here in 2011?
Well, I was under the impression it was going to be for at least 100 years.
All right.
After all, we've only sunk the roots now. Now it's time to grow the tree, you know.
What do you think has been the key to that business thriving and surviving when a lot of other businesses in that genre have not?
Well, again, I feel that God gave me the employees. I didn't get them myself, and I have the without a doubt the best team as possible, and they have a quality of being honest. They are hardworking, and I think that's the key to everything. I appreciate what they do every day.
And I'm pretty sure they appreciate you, too. I think I can safely say that. I appreciate you telling some of these stories. I know it's not always easy. I look forward to reading the rest of them in the book. In closing, when you look back on all of it and the life that you describe yourself as having a very blessed life, what are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
The fact that I've had such wonderful people to work with and to be around and day in, day out. It's been a very, very wonderful experience.
Want to go fly a B-17 next week?
I doubt if any of them are flying anymore.
There's a couple, but something tells me if you had the opportunity, you'd climb back into that cockpit. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for what you've done for our community.
Thank you.
Mike Murphy has been our guest today. If you want to read a little bit more about him, wait for that book to come out. You can also see a picture of him at kmjnow.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.